I'm Dan Cassidy, and this is UBS's Top of the Morning. Today, we revisit our equity sector conversation and turn our focus to the communication services space. We will provide a sector overview, speak to where challenges exist, discuss an outlook, and more. And joining me today for the conversation is Technology and Communication Services Analyst Americas Kevin Dineen and Equity Associate Analyst Americas Reed Gilligan, both from the UBS Chief Investment Office. So, Kevin and Reed, good morning to you both. Great to be with you, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be back.
So I know the equity team currently recommends a moderate overweight to the U.S. communication services sector. Kevin, what are the reasons underpinning your view, and what are the challenges you are watching on a going forward basis?
Yeah, I think on a short-term basis, one thing that we find attractive about the communication services sector is it's really a consumer-focused sector. So in a world or an environment where the macro is really uncertain, we're not sure what's happening with, let's say, IT spending, which could impact the technology sector. In a world where the picture on trade is still uncertain, we like the consumer focus of the sector, and that's a very tactical view. On a longer term view, we like the underpinnings here. At a high level, we think you get a good combination of solid earnings growth, attractive valuation, and even a little bit of a dividend yield. And then if we look at sort of the individual legs of those drivers, we think of it as being pretty simple. We think it's connectivity, we think it's content, and we think it's advertising. On the content side, it's all the videos that we consume, all the media that we consume, and how that's changing and evolving as things become more digital, more direct to the consumer. On the connectivity side, that's wireless, but it's also cable. And the cable companies are benefiting in a surprise. They're actually benefiting from what we see happening in cord cutting. And then with advertising, that's a huge global industry. It's being disrupted and continues to be disrupted by digital. That's no surprise. But I think what is a surprise to a lot of people is when we put some numbers around it. And I think an important number to keep in mind is that digital as a percentage of total global advertising is still less than 50%. So even just on app basis, we think there's a lot more room to growth, but to grow. But even more so than just the numbers, we have this view that digital actually democratizes advertising. And what I mean by that is because of the reach of digital, because of the targeting, any business of any size can target any consumer in the world with any product that they want. And that's what we mean by democratization. It gives a whole new level of reach, and it enables a whole new class of ad buyers. So what does this mean? We think ultimately that the advertising market ends up being bigger than anybody's thinking about because you've drawn in this new pool of ad buyers.
Kevin, you spoke about content as being one of three pillars for the industry. Reed, can you spend a few moments diving into a few tailwinds and headwinds the content landscape currently faces?
Yeah, just building off what Kevin said, it is a really exciting time for the consumer in this space. There's a really growing array of OTT services, but it's coming at a high cost for the industry. Now first, talk about skinny bundles, which focus on live television. They're actually seeing subscriber growth rates decline, forcing them to add channels and increase prices. This is really hurting the value of what a skinny bundle offers. We dig into this in the report, but it's looking a lot more like a chubby bundle.
So I'm going to jump in. I'm pretty sure we actually made that up because a lot of times I come up with this.
You're first.
Yes. A lot of times I come up with a saying or something catchy, and I think I created it, but then I found out that somebody else had it. But when we were working on this, on this report, the chubby bundle jumped out and I Googled it. And I think we are the creators of the term, the chubby bundle.
Kevin's claim to fame, the chubby bundle.
That is, yeah.
Okay. As you were saying, Reed.
Yeah. Jumping into the entertainment, the non-live television side, there's a growing number of DTC or direct-to-consumer video on-demand services. And we've seen a number being launched over the past few weeks. A big one's being launched today. A few of the traditional media companies are launching theirs next year. But with more services competing for subscribers, talent, and content, the costs are really adding up. And we can see that with new shows being being given huge budgets over $10 to $15 million an episode, or existing shows are being sold for hundreds of million dollars for only a 5-year exclusivity deal. Now, we're seeing companies willing to take operating profit losses in the short term to grow a subscriber base now, with the goal of breaking even down the line.
So, Reed, how do you see the industry down the road? What's your outlook there?
This type of content spend with this many competitors just isn't sustainable. So we think there's going to be some sort of shakeout in the next couple of years, leaving only 3 to 4 major global services that will gain the subscribers needed and to stay profitable and cash flow positive. Then we can add on smaller providers offering niche content just because the barriers to entry in the industry are so low. Now, another theme we see is aggregators. So the user experience now is a little annoying when you have to click into your different video on demand services to try to find a TV show or movie that you want to watch. We think aggregators will play an important role in combining all of your service content together and then being able to search and find kind of the shows or the television that you want to watch at that moment.
Kevin, I know the report talks about video subscribers declining since 2012, and the younger generation is more likely to never purchase cable television. I think I'm the only millennial that does. I need to revisit that. But Kevin, how has the cable industry dealt with the so-called cord cutters?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things have happened. I mean, If you think back to 2018, the cable companies, the stocks were under pressure because of fears of cord cutting and fears of 5G. And we'll talk about 5G in a second. I think what everybody learned is that when subscribers cut the cord, they often upgrade their internet package. So I might pay less for video because I'm cutting the cord and taking over the top services on a sort of a la carte basis. But at the same time, I'm going to my cable company and saying, well, I need you to upgrade my internet from maybe it's 100 megabit per second to 200 megabit per second. It still works out for the consumer. They can still end up spending less. I know that's been my experience. But that incremental monthly revenue that the cable company is getting, it's coming in at really high revenue. So the bottom line is, as cord cutters keep cutting cords, as subscribers start taking chubby bundles, had to get that one in there again. What you see are the cable companies actually, yes, they're losing video revenues, but they're more than making it up with high margin upgrades to their internet packages.
Kevin, I do want to spend a few moments just as a follow-up bringing 5G into the conversation. I think you were on with me in mid-September. Yep. When you released your blog, 5G Refresh. A lot has happened in 2 years, which was co-authored with Reed. But how will 5G, Kevin, come into play in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, we're watching this closely. I think that if we look over the arc of time, the progress on 5G, there's definitely been progress, a particularly straight line, and I think some of the expectations have shifted around. So if I go back to when we first started writing about 5G, which I think was more than 2 years ago, myself and a lot of people in the industry, fixed wireless access was the most exciting part of this. It seemed to be the application of 5G that could hit the soonest. To be clear, what fixed wireless access is, internet service delivered to your home, but instead of over a cable from a cable company, it uses a 5G network. The wireless carriers plan to bring this service to market at a very competitive price versus your traditional cable provider. I think that we haven't seen that scale up yet. There's been some trials. I think they're still working out some of the technology issues. I think there's been some delays in some of the they're called releases by the standards bodies that set minimum requirements and definitions for the services that got delayed. I think that sort of backed up the process. So I think the focus on 5G has shifted away from fixed wireless for now and into mobile. So putting 5G into your smartphone. And I think that's going to be the first and fastest, easiest win, if I could put it that way. So I don't know if we're going to see a lot of fixed wireless access in 2020, but when we start thinking about 2021 or 2022, then I think we will. And to be clear, it's not a solution for everywhere. It's going to work best in dense urban and suburban environments. It won't cover the whole country, but it's going to cover a lot of subscribers and it's going to cover a lot of share of wallet, and something that we need to keep an eye on as a competitor to the cable companies.
Okay, so more to come on 5G, which I know is a topic many are interested in, so we'll have some follow-up conversations on that specific topic. But getting back to the U.S. communications sector, broadly speaking, Reid, I know the sector is supported by advertising. Can you spend a few moments digging into the strength of the advertising industry and any drivers that will spur on further growth?
Yeah, Dan. So Kevin touched on this in the beginning, but really the advertising industry still has plenty of wind in its sails. And he talked about the shift to digital advertising. So the TV ad industry used to be easily the largest, the dominant player, but we're really seeing this shift to digital, shift to over the internet advertising. And for the first time in 2019, digital will account for 50% of global ad spend. We see this as offering a ton of opportunity, continued advertising growth, and within digital advertising, as Kevin said, he thinks this democratizes the advertising industry to allow medium and small businesses to really reach a larger consumer base, which helps the growth rates. Also, the ability of targeted advertising and better tracking metrics really offers a measurable increase in ROI, which we believe supports further growth theme within the ad industry. Now, looking ahead to 2020, the ad industry is actually expected to get a spend boost from cyclical events such as the Olympics and the U.S. election cycle.
So, Kevin, I know a common headline around the internet industry right now is regulation. And over the past few weeks and months, we've seen some marquee executives and names testifying up on Capitol Hill. Can you speak on the current regulation issues the sector faces and how it could possibly play out in 2020?
Yeah, I think that we've been concerned about the regulatory headwinds for the sector since the beginning of January of 18, when we wrote a report highlighting GDPR, which is European regulations. They weren't put in place at that time. They were instituted May of 18. And we said, look, it may not result in any substantive change to the way these companies operate, but it probably serves to dampen sentiment. And I think it's largely played out the script. So where are we today? You know, these headwinds aren't going away anytime soon. I think, though, that with 2 years' experience of watching this, I think we can say a couple of things. These are really big, large, complex ecosystems. I think regulators are taking a sort of cautious approach to how they're attempting to regulate these industries. And as a, for instance, I'd go through the experience in Europe. When GDPR was instituted, what happened was the largest internet platforms actually gained share. So it was sort of like a flight to safety. I don't think we're going to see and it's important to point this out because the European regulators identified a problem in the marketplace that they saw. They didn't tell companies how to solve the problem. They just told them what they wanted the outcome to look like. This is across GDPR and across a handful of other regulatory issues that came up in Europe. So my point here is the regulators didn't get inside of these large companies and sort of take out processes or tell them what they had to do. They really told them, here's what we want the marketplace to look like. Here's the environment we want to see. And I think that's the only way that we can really see regulation. These are big global companies. It's a big global industry. I don't think you can have really islands of regulation that are very different across different regions.
If you don't mind, Kevin, what is GDPR in the context of the conversation?
Sorry, I've said it so many times. I feel like everybody knows it by now, so I apologize for that. General Data Protection Rules.
Doesn't have the same ring as the chubby bun.
Nothing does. It's probably the high water mark of my career. It basically it deals with what data is allowed to be collected as a consumer, the rights that you have to know where the data goes, who's using it, how it's being used. And it sets up a lot of penalties for that, for misuse of that data. And the fear was that by making data less available or by highlighting to people that their data was being used in certain ways, you'd either see user engagement decline, or there wouldn't be enough data to prove the ROI and investment of advertising dollars, and that would slow advertising. That may have happened in the secondary and third tier platforms, but the leading global tier platforms actually have seen accelerating revenues. And I think that's what we're going to see going forward. Now, I will say this. We can talk about regulatory, but I don't think we should conflate regulatory with political. I think political is very different, and we're going to have to watch what happens in the elections very carefully, because there are a number of candidates on both sides that are calling vigorously for restructuring the industry, and even to the point of calling for breakups of some of these major platforms on a basis that the acquisitions were anti-competitive, which I think if you look back in history, when some of these deals were done, they were like less than 1% of the market cap of the companies at the time. It's really hard to say that that was anti-competitive.
Has that rhetoric have any implications thus far to how the sector has traded?
Yeah, I think that what it ultimately has done is the companies have talked more about policing themselves, and some companies have actually increased spending around that. So that's the press margins, but that sort of seems to have shaken itself out. I think what's happened and what will continue to happen is this regulatory and political uncertainty dampens investor sentiment, resulting in lower valuation multiples for these companies than they would have otherwise given the growth. You know, our bottom line view is that these large internet companies are exceptionally cheap for what they are. They're probably going to stay that way for some period of time. So we think that any stock price appreciation really will come from earnings growth and EBITDA growth more so than valuation changing. And that's okay. I think we can still get pretty good returns. And that's one of the reasons why we're positive on the sector.
Kevin, just drilling a bit deeper into positioning, and Reed, feel free to weigh in as well. What do you like within the communication services sector? Where are you currently seeing the most opportunity?
You know, at a high level, we like media over telecom. And that's really a reflection of, we think media has better growth prospects. So inside of media, that's the internet companies, that's some of the cable companies. Traditional media companies, which face headwinds as they face declining viewership, declining advertising revenues, sometimes even declining licensing of their content. That's more than offset by the positives that are happening. In telecom, you know, we're neutral there. There's not a lot of choices. What we like in telecom are companies that have diversified away from wireless, because we think the U.S. wireless market is saturated. It's been pretty tame in terms of competition for the last year or so. We think that's poised to heat back up. So we want sort of companies that have diversified away from traditional U.S. wireless and that are what we call self-help stories. So a lot of times what that comes down to are companies that are aggressively paying back their debt.
Okay. Well, Kevin and Reed, really appreciate the time and insight. Congratulations on the sector initiation. I know you're assuming sole coverage now of U.S. communication services, but appreciate you spending a few moments walking us through the scope of the industry, where you're seeing challenges, where you're seeing opportunities, sidebar and 5G as well, and learning about the Chubby bundle. That was fun.
Appreciate Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
And again, we've been joined by Kevin Dineen, Technology and Communication Services Analyst Americas, as well as Reed Gilligan, Equity Associate Analyst Americas, both from the UBS Chief Investment Office. And there are many publications available now up on UBS Online Services, though I do want to highlight the publication that ties directly into our conversation. That is Kevin and Reed's U.S. Communication Services Equity Preference List, which again, up now on UBS Online Services. So if you are a client of UBS, just reach out to your financial advisor. They can provide you a copy of the publication directly. Top of the morning. We'll be back again for you tomorrow morning. Have a great day, everyone.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers both investment advisory services and brokerage services, which are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and governed by different laws and separate contracts. For more information, visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. All rights reserved. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA SIPC.